today we've got a special guest all the way from New Zealand. His name is Andrew London. Welcome, Andrew, to the show.
Thanks very much, guys. Very nice to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Andrew.
Well, I live in a little town called Otaki, which is about an hour north of the capital of New Zealand, Wellington, in the North Island. It's by the sea. And I'm pretty much a full-time musician. I play in 3, 4, maybe 5 different bands. I'm a guitarist and a singer, which is a very fortunate thing to be, of course, because it means that you can pretty much just say yes to anything you're offered and then gather people around you to fulfill the brief of the gig. I'm approaching 60, so I guess at the tail end of the baby boomer generation, so I was brought up on a diet of blues oriented pop music like the Beatles, the Stones, Led Zeppelin, a lot of American stuff, you know, the Allman Brothers and Lynyrd Skynyrd were very popular, the acoustic players, Neil Young, Bob Dylan, James Taylor, Van Morrison, Eric Clapton, all that stuff was very influential, of course, to me as a teenager. It's what I was growing up with. Didn't have much to do with country music. It was a little bit laughed at, to be honest. The only country music we were aware of, to be honest, in my youth was kind of Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton. Maybe a bit of Johnny Cash, and, you know, we thought it was all a bit laughable, really. Frilly shirts and top and 10-gallon hats, you know, and we didn't know much about it. But as I said to you in our preamble to the interview, there was a band who kind of burst onto the onto our TV screens, and there was only one channel in these days, late 60s, early 70s. We only had one TV channel, and of course there was an annual New Faces music competition, Showbiz. A show, and there was a band called the Hamilton County Bluegrass Band who burst onto the scene and won the competition one year and became household names, and that was our introduction to bluegrass music, I suppose, which became very popular for a little while, which I've always loved since. My father was very musical, didn't play anything, but he was a big jazz fan. And he loved singers, Sinatra, Crosby, Ella Fitzgerald, the big band music of Count Basie, Benny Goodman, Glenn Miller. We listened to a lot of that, a lot of Louis Armstrong. He was a big Armstrong fan, Nat King Cole. And the Rat Pack era was, of course, you know, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis, Frank Sinatra. So that a lot of movies, of course, musical movies. So I think I had a much broader musical upbringing than most of my peers who were kind of like me, were really into the pop music at the time. But I became a pretty big jazz fan as a result of that. And so I've always had this kind of duality to my musical endeavors. I've been a full-time musician most of my life, except for long periods where I've been a retailer. I've worked in music stores selling instruments, and I owned and managed one myself up until about 20 years ago.
Okay.
When I managed to get rid of it, it was down in Wellington in the capital, and my wife and I ran away up here to the coast. And ever since then, I've been eking out a living as a full-time musician. I don't teach, so I mostly just gig. It's mostly what I've been doing for the last 20 years. And so being a singer guitarist, of course, is a fortunate thing. I can do solo gigs, and I do little cafes, bars, restaurants, hotels and stuff. My most successful endeavor over the last 20 years has been it was a little trio, bass. I played guitar, I had a bass player, and the third party in the trio was usually either a fiddle player or a harmonica player or a saxophonist. And most often it was a saxophonist, and we would do a lot of jazz standards. But we veered into a lot of blues, a bit of country music. One of the saxophone players played a bit of Irish whistle, so we played a bit of Celtic music. And over recent times, we've been playing a lot of kind of veering away from the jazz and more into the Western swing. So a bit more of a country feel. A lot of Bob Wills tunes. We pinched a lot of repertoire from Asleep at the Wheel. There's a very good trio out of Fort Worth that we like called the Hot Club of Cowtown. Not sure whether you're familiar with them, but they're very popular. They tour a lot around the world, around the States. So that's morphed over the last 7 or 8 years into what I now call just the Andrew London Trio. For various reasons, the first trio I was in was called Hot Club Sandwich, and that's changed now to the Andrew London Trio. And it was an effort to kind of get my name out there a little bit more. Mm-hmm. The repertoire is original now. The songs that I write, whilst stylistically they're very much in the swing or jazz or Western swing genre, the subject matter is mostly satirical or a whimsical kind of social comment. And that's our point of difference, I guess. And we do get a lot of repeat bookings, festival bookings on the basis of that point of difference, that there's a large degree of humour, musical comedy and satire in the subject matter. So that's as a writer, that's my point of difference, I guess.
Now, when you're writing those songs with the satire involved, are you basing it on current events or just kind of something that comes to mind at the time?
Yeah, sometimes current events, and there's a trap in that, of course, and that is that your song can be very topical and popular for a very limited amount of time, of course, because as soon as that particular event or subject is off the public radar, then the song ceases to become really relevant.
Yes.
So I tend not to write too much about current events. It's more about societal obsessions and quirky idiosyncrasies. For instance, the songs that have been most popular over the last few years, I have one called Appliances, which is about going shopping for household appliances. You know, and they change all the time, of course. I've got one called Let's Talk About Me, which is about people that talk about themselves a lot. I've got a song called My Daughter's Got a Boyfriend, which is about the generation gap. And that's perennial, of course. That's timeless, you know, that it's about the daughter bringing home the boyfriend with the face piercings and tattoos and backwards baseball cap and his pants down, you know, halfway down to his knees. And,
but as long as it's not Frank Sinatra, you're okay, right?
Well, that's right. Actually, that's right. I do have a song called "I Never Let My Daughter Out" with Frank Sinatra. So getting the ideas is the hard part. The writing of the songs is quite easy, but getting the ideas is quite difficult. I'm working on one at the moment called "There's No Such Thing as Toast on Beans," which was inspired by a trip on the Inter-Island Ferry we did recently, which has a cafe in it. And to cut a long story short, you order your breakfast and you get your scrambled eggs and your bacon and your baked beans, and then they slap the toast on top, which seemed to be backwards to the way things ought to be, according to my way of thinking. So I'm just working on a song about that at the moment. So, yeah, it's funny little everyday things. People seem to like it. You know, I think it was a deliberate ploy on my part to try not to. I remember I was writing. I've never written very much, but I started about 20 years ago when we had this little swing trio called Hot Club Sandwich. And my wife's uncle, who's quite a successful musician down in this part of the world, said to me, "You've got to start writing. You've got to start writing your own stuff." And I started writing my own stuff. But when you write and you're new to it, I think there's a tendency to go for the cliche quite often. You know, you tend to find yourself using, for instance, in the blues world, it'd be things like "Woke up early this morning, may as well lay me down and die." You know, "If lonesome, I could cry." Heard that whistle blowing. You know, these are cliches, and if you were writing a blues song, you would try and avoid them. I was writing kind of little swing tunes in the Tin Pan Alley, you know, Great American Songbook kind of style, and I was deliberately trying to find subject matter that there weren't a million songs about already. So that's why I think it was quite a deliberate ploy on my part to start writing quirky little idiosyncratic songs that would make people's ears prick up, because it's funny to hear someone singing about household appliances or beans on toast or something.
I'm curious what your audience, your typical audience that enjoys your music is. Are they typically older or younger or somewhere in between?
They're definitely older, Marissa, and I think it's probably mostly because of the style of music that we play. I think that older people, you know, they recognize the Frank Sinatra references. They recognize I mean, I'm nearly 60, and I guess most of my audience are at least 60 or over. They like the swing genre. They can identify with it, perhaps. And also, of course, we're getting to the stage where most of the gigs we do are to sit down listening audiences. We're not playing in pubs and bars for dancing, drinking. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We don't do a lot of that anymore. Most of our shows are just that. They're shows these days. Well, I think that's a culture that older people are familiar with. They're familiar with going to theatres. They don't mind sitting down. They get it. You know, they get sitting down and listening and attending a show. Whereas I don't think that's something younger people are exposed to as much these days. Would that be a fair comment on?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, everything is so instantaneous now with the younger generations that it's like, well, why wouldn't I just watch somebody on YouTube? Why would I go out of my house to watch some music?
Yeah, I think they also like the freedom of being able to leave if they want to. You know, that's why going to a bar or whatever. They can go get a drink and watch a little bit of music and then walk out if they want to. But
right, well, that's really interesting, isn't it? I hadn't kind of thought about that in any great depth, but that's interesting you should say that.
I wouldn't say it's because they don't like the music. I would just say they don't have
the attention span.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to suggest that, but I didn't. I wasn't sure where that might be, but.
I think social media is a big part of that too. Is kind of what Marissa was saying, instantaneous,
gratification,
commitment free.
Yeah.
You don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's the bottom line. You know, I need to get people to part with money and come out to shows. And if you can't do that, then you're finished, you know? So that's the constant challenge, I guess. That's what I spend most of my days on, a little bit of social media, but writing emails. I have extensive email newsletter list, and it's getting those 60 pluses who are still comfortable with that culture, I suppose. To actually come out and part with some money and sit down for a couple of hours and listen to you, and then hopefully buy your CD, which is becoming increasingly difficult as well. Hard to buy a car with a CD player in it these days, even.
So are you one of those guys that keeps a stack of CDs like in your trunk at all times in case someone wants to buy one?
Yeah, absolutely I am. Yeah.
I want to be that type of person.
It's not called the trunk.
What?
As in the trunk of your car, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, we call it the boot.
What did I say?
They call it the boot.
The boot.
Yeah.
I think we mentioned that he's from New Zealand.
I did.
You did? Okay. Yeah.
I think we discussed that briefly at the start. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah. Very good.
So it's autumn here. It's not fall.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, it makes more sense.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool though. So, as far as marketing your material, would you say you have a lot of success with selling CDs and doing, you could say, the old-fashioned way?
I don't know whether it achieves much from a marketing perspective, and it, of course it achieves even less from an income perspective these days. I tell you what I think it's useful for, and that is credibility.
Uh-huh.
I think to be able to say we're recording a new album, the new album is out, to actually stick some in envelopes and send them out to festival directors, perhaps radio stations, and venue owners and corporate event organizers is still quite a good calling card.
Mm-hmm.
And to put something in front of people, it gives you a bit of cred in the industry.
Yeah.
I think. Certainly the days of selling them are drifting. They're tailing off.
Yes, definitely.
And the days of selling downloads, similarly, of course, are tailing off as well, as all people do now is streaming, of course, is the big thing, and that results in no income virtually at all for the artist.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're Taylor Swift, obviously, or Ed Sheeran.
Right.
Hundreds of millions of streams every day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, if you can find a loyal audience in a way that works for you, you know, stick to it.
Yeah. Well, that's what it's all about for me. Yeah, I've spent 20 years building it up, you know, one by one. We've traveled the length and breadth of this country 100 times and played in every little one-horse town and we can, and every gig I see as an opportunity to get a couple of new fans and a couple of new email addresses. And I sent an email newsletter out yesterday. I do it once a month to about 2,500 recipients now.
Wow!
And it has the result that mostly, if we're going to just about any part of New Zealand, I can generate at least a paying audience. You know, it might only be 30 or 40 people, but it can be enough to make the trip worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And that's been a really good result. Obviously, the selling of CDs in the past has been quite lucrative. Only in terms of selling at gigs. You know, we've never been able to sell them in any commercially viable number. Through retail outlets or anywhere else, but sometimes we've been able to do all right just selling them at gigs. So we've got this small but loyal following of mostly over 60s, I guess. The downside to that is, of course, they're dying off slowly. But there are still plenty of them out there, and there will be enough of them out there to see me out over the next, you know, 20 years. I'm sure. We just have to keep farming.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that a lot of your music is I know that you've focused on that. Well, I shouldn't say focused, but you've grown that fan base of people that are 60 plus years old. But I think that a lot of your music is relatable to all the ages, I guess. Especially
we liked the Facebook song.
Yeah,
a lot.
Facebook song. That's one that I think everybody can relate to in some way, shape, or form. And whether it's from like a negative perspective or a positive perspective, however people view social media. But that's, I think that, I think you're adapting and finding ways to relate to not only your current fan base, but future fans as well.
Yeah, I think writing about anything topical, well, anything that focuses on the pace of change, particularly technological change, is going to get, it's going to get ears. Ears are going to prick up, younger ears perhaps. It's something that appeals to them, I guess. Yes, so that's, it's not really a deliberate ploy on my part. I think even though I'm writing the odd song about technology, for instance, there's one called I Can't Keep Up, and the Facebook song is a good example. I think it appeals as much to the young, to the older, as it does to the younger. I mean, obviously the younger people, they're familiar with the subject matter, but I guess the way I write about it is the way a 60-year-old would write about it. It probably resonates more with the older demographic than the younger still. You know, I don't know if there's a way. I think that because of the style of the music that I write in, I'm never really going to appeal too much to the 20 and 30 somethings.
Besides us.
Yeah, well, you're academics. You're interested. You know, you're actually sort of researching the subject. So thank God for you.
Well, what advice would you have for people that maybe are writing songs part-time here or there, but would consider themselves maybe just like a part-time musician or just something as a hobby? What advice would you give someone that wants to turn it into a full-time gig as you have done?
Wow. Yeah, I think there's only one way to do that for someone my age. I think that's to get out and play them. Although, having just said that, I'm told, and I've no reason to doubt it, that the way forward these days is just to get it up on social media. I think there are a lot of writers and acts, musicians, who've made a career wholly, haven't they, by through social media. And if you can get something to go viral on YouTube or some other platform, then that's a great way to do it. I was just thinking just then of that guy who, can't remember his name, but he wrote a song you might be aware of called, is it Virgin Rex Guitars? He was a musician. He flew on Virgin Airlines. They put a forklift through his guitar. He wrote a song about it. He wrote a song about it and did a very low budget, but quite funny video for it.
Yeah, we know exactly what you're talking about, how they destroyed his Martin guitar or whatever.
His Taylor guitar.
Yeah, and I think the company came to the party, didn't they, and gave him a couple of new ones or something.
Yeah.
I read about that guy, and he's now making a very good living on the speaking circuit, touring the USA, speaking various corporate functions about exactly that thing. So if you can get something to go viral like that, which perhaps just taps into some little piece of social awareness, social consciousness, well, then you've cracked it, haven't you? But I guess you can't expect to do that. I mean, that's a novelty song, and which is very much like what I do, I suppose. So maybe that's why that resonated with me. If you're writing, serious songs, I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you do it. I mean, you know, if you're going to be in the, what do you do if you want to get a song to Taylor Swift or on the Nashville TV program? How do you do that? I've no idea. There's a saying that the cream rises to the top, and if you're really good, someone will notice. But how do you even do that nowadays? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't
know. And write more.
For me, it's getting out and playing them, getting to an audience and playing them, and just building that audience, you know, two at a time.
And maybe not having a retail store.
Well, no, that's right. That's right. Well, that's not much, not going to do you much good these days. I they say that it's easier nowadays because of the internet, but I wonder about that. How do you get noticed in amongst the scrum, just the swamp on the internet? How do you get your stuff to rise to the top? I've no idea.
There's already so many out there that
saturated. Yeah. Even if yours is better, how do you get it noticed?
Yeah. When you do shows, do you prefer to perform locally, or do you like to travel a little bit? And is your fan base local, or are they kind of spread out as well?
Actually, it's very difficult to get any traction locally. I think anyone will tell you that. It's the old story of the prophet in his own land. Is that the phrase? People know who you are, and they get blasé, of course, and complacent. Why do I want to go and see him again? He's always popping up. We don't have to go and pay to see him, because he's going to pop up next week down at the local cafe, and we can go and hear him free anyway. And that's the challenge as well for an act like me, for a musician like me. I have friends locally in the same boat who chose to do it differently. They simply don't play locally. Maybe twice a year they'll do a paid show locally, and that's it. But for me, I do it full time. I have no other income. So if the local cafe wants me to come and play on a Sunday, well, I'll go and do it, you know, because I'll get enough. It might not be worth a lot, but it's enough to pay the grocery bill this week. So I do a lot locally. I do several cafes on a semi-regular basis. I do the local RSA, which is, I don't know whether you have anything similar over there. It's called the Return Services Association. It's like a club. It's mostly older people. It's a chartered club. We go and play there. They ballroom dance. So we do that maybe twice a month. What do you call that?
I just said it sounds like
fun. Sounds fun. We need to start one over here.
Yeah. We've had them for 100 years, I think. Some of them are coming up for after the First World War. They set them up for returned servicemen. So I do quite a lot locally. And consequently, it becomes very difficult to do anything big, because no one wants to pay to see you, because they're seeing you all the time at the smaller venues, you know. So for us, it's necessary, it's critical that we travel, which is a shame, because I'm getting less inclined to want to do so the older I get. But we absolutely have to do it. We're going to Norfolk Island in another 3 or 4 months. Now, that's a small island about halfway between here and Australia. Population of about 2,000 people. Wow. They have an annual jazz festival, and we're going to that. We're going to Melbourne, which is obviously in Australia, in June for a week to do some gigs. We're going to Auckland, which is the biggest city in New Zealand. A couple of million people, and that's about a 7 or 8 hour drive for us, and we're doing half a dozen gigs up there. We're going to Christchurch, which is a ferry trip, and then a 5 or 6 hour drive. We're going down there and later in the year to do half a dozen gigs. So it's crucial for us to do this.
Because, and do you book everything yourself, or do you have a manager of some kind?
No, I have to do it all myself, and we tend to stay with friends when we do these trips in order to reduce the cost. We have an arrangement with the inter-island New Zealand is basically two islands, and there's a regular ferry service between the two, and they have a very good system for musicians. If you play for a couple of hours on the ferry, in the bar on the ferry, on the way over and back, they'll give you free passage, which
wow. That's sweet.
Well, it's absolutely crucial. It enables musicians to do inter-island tours. If they didn't do that, it would cost about $600.
It's, wow.
Which is I think probably about $400 US, and that can be the difference between success and failure, actually, in terms of inter-island travel. So that's a very crucial facility, a crucial service. So once or twice a year we try and do a South Island trip, and once or twice a year we try and do a trip, you know, all around the North Island and go to the provincial towns once or twice a year. It's absolutely crucial. We couldn't do it just by sitting here in our own town.
Well, it sounds like a blast. That's something we would like to do someday, is to do some more touring and traveling, especially as we're a little bit younger. We just long to see some new places and try new experiences. So I'm sure that's fun, but I also understand that home is where the heart is as well.
Well, it is perhaps for my wife and I. She plays in my band with me. She's my bass player.
Oh, that's wonderful.
It is. It's very cool. We just started doing it over the last 7 or 8 years, and six or seven really, and it's been really good. Our kids are just about left home. One's in his last year of school, so that's going to free us up a bit. She's keener than me, I must say, to travel. We've done a little bit of cruise ship work in the last 2 or 3 years around the Pacific and Indonesia. We don't really enjoy that very much, I have to be honest and say. Visiting the places is quite interesting, but the cruise ship experience for musicians working, to be honest, is not that great. Playing is okay, the gigs are okay, but the experience generally is very difficult. I don't know whether you know much about that particular.
Yeah, a little bit.
Have you done a bit of that?
No, but I have been on a couple of cruises and can assume things.
Yeah.
I did not like being on a cruise ship. I don't like the feeling of being on water and not escaping.
Right.
But, yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't bother us that much, although my wife's not a great sailor. it wasn't that bothered us. Yeah, I don't want to dwell on it too much, but it's quite a humiliating experience. Anything on a ship, of course, is a kind of quasi-military arrangement. Obviously, it's very hierarchical, and if you're used to organising all your own gigs and being responsible for your own destiny and running your gigs yourself, it's quite humiliating and demeaning being in an environment where someone a third of your age tells you where to play, when to play, what to wear, what to play. You have to do a lot of drills, and you have to fit into a very low rung on the hierarchy, and it's quite difficult.
Sounds like it takes away from your creativity quite a bit. Creativity and freedom of doing a little bit,
a little bit. Although we find that the actual playing is quite good, because what we find is that on a cruise ship we play a lot of standards and a lot of songs that people know and draw them in, and then we give them a few of our original, you know, humorous satirical songs, and they usually go down quite well. So the actual playing is quite enjoyable. I think part of it also is that we get crew cabins, which tend to be very Spartan.
I've heard about that.
Down on the lower decks, you know, so it's not luxurious at all, that can be quite difficult to cope with. But anyway, you know, it's something that it's quite lucrative for us to do that. So we don't mind doing little short, 1 or 2 week cruises around the Pacific. Can be okay, and we've. I shouldn't be too dismissive of them, because they've been quite good the last few years.
It's good information.
Yeah, that's definitely really good advice for the listeners, and I know for us too as well. It is good to know that, you know, more opportunities, or there's better opportunities, I guess, when you're traveling around and getting to the unfamiliar areas. Probably helps grow your fan base. Like you said, people kind of get to know you in the local areas, so they're not as excited to see you, I guess, and they get used to your company and to your music, and so that's really good to know, and that's something I think a lot of people will.
Yeah, you know. I think it's and if you're young, look, why wouldn't you? Look, stick a mattress in the back of a van and get out there, you know. Because you don't care when you're young, you know. You can sleep in the back of a van and you rotate the driving, and you don't mind, do you? So it's all exciting. So you know, if there are younger listeners out there, you have to do it. You have to do it, and you have to get out there and play and experience those things and get your music out to as many people as possible. And of course, yeah, I suppose the whole email thing has been crucial for me and for my demographic, but I guess it's all about social media these days. If you get a couple of thousand people following you on Facebook, then you've got a fan base from which you can hopefully draw a crowd whenever you do something that you need to draw a crowd to.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I've heard email lists are very effective as well.
I don't think email lists will ever die. I think that is a marketing tool that's still going to go strong here for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I hope so. It certainly does a lot for me. Certainly more so than the social media. I mean, I do Facebook quite heavily, but I'm not convinced that it works that well for me at this stage.
Yes. Yeah, I think too many algorithms.
Emails are a little more. They get your fans involved a little bit more, where they're reading and
check it when they need to or want to, and come back to it.
It's in their inbox instead of just on a scroll feed. Where
yes.
You know, they can go read your email and I know when I'm on social media as a viewer, I'm just scrolling through, and if, you know, I'll pass things all the time that I'm just not interested in at that moment, and then I'll never go back to them because it's long gone in the feed somewhere.
Yeah.
Whereas an email is sitting there waiting for you, and you can go read it, take the time to read it, and
yes, I've been tempted. It's been suggested to me I should be getting into Instagram and maybe one or two of the others, but I just don't think my demographic are that interested. Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't think so, Marissa?
No, I think that you're doing what's working for you, and you know, you don't want to overfeed the horse.
Excellent. Well put.
Yeah.
Marissa's always coming up with new sayings on this show.
Yeah. Yeah,
no,
I'll
use
that. Thank you.
Yeah. Don't overfeed the horse.
Yeah.
If it's working,
just keep doing what's working, you know. If it's not working, obviously, you can always try something different.
Yeah,
but if it's working, then just keep on.
And there's so many factors that go into what works for you. You know, who's your audience? What kind of music do you play? Where are you from? You know, where are you playing?
Mm-hmm. What is your cost of living too?
Yeah, what's your cost of living?
Think, you know, musicians in LA have a harder time paying their bills than where we live in rural Tennessee.
Yeah, with our high demand of a pet that we have.
Yeah.
Mr. Ralph. Yeah. Well, Andrew, we appreciate you coming on the show today, and last thing we want to ask you is where people can go to find your music and find more about you.
Well, I have a website, andrewlondon.co.nz, and there are links on that to everywhere that will be interesting. And I'd really appreciate you guys reaching out from all the way over in Tennessee to have a chat. I'm sorry that I can't see you because you're very fine looking. I'm sorry you can't see me. I'm sorry. You're much better looking people than I am. So that's me. It's been okay. And I anybody out there who's getting into songwriting, I wish them all the best. It's very rewarding, if not terribly lucrative.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. And if we're ever in New Zealand, we hope that we can meet up with for lunch or something with you. We would love that.
That would be
a cuppa.
A cuppa, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Love to have you for a cuppa or a honey.
A honey. I haven't heard that one yet. Colleen's taught me the cuppa.
Oh, well, the honey is a traditional Maori meal of roast meat and vegetables cooked underground around hot stones.
All right, I'm sold.
And you had me at cooked.
You had me at meat.
Yeah, buried and then dug up after a few hours. Yeah, that's a honey.
That's awesome.
That sounds really good.
It is good.
All right, well, listeners, you heard it here. You need to go check out his music, and we're so grateful for you coming on the show today. Thanks so much.
Thank you all the best.